Good evening, everyone. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Women leaders at the table addressing inequity in the good food movement. How are you all doing today? Good? It's good to see the matriarchy in full effect. So, thank you. My name is Shakira Simley. I'm the Community Programs Manager for the Byright Family of Businesses here in San Francisco, and I also sit on the Board of Directors for the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, CUESA. I want to welcome you all in person at the beautiful Swedish American Hall, and I definitely want to note the generosity of the Natimas Restaurant Group, so thank you for giving us the space. We sold out of our first space. And all of you were knocking at the doors and sending me 1,000 texts and emails, so we were able to get this space by their generosity. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us at thecommonwealthclub.org. This program will be recorded and uploaded to the Commonwealth Club website within the next 24 to 48 hours. So, to set the scene, over the past several years, we've seen national conversation and movements building against racism, violence against Black and brown people, and rising inequality. The good food movement, in upholding the values of good, clean, and fair, is also subject to these conversations and critical lens. From the exploitation of workers in our fields and kitchens, to displacement from land and home, to inadequate access to quality food and associated negative health impacts, our conversation this evening will problematize not only what's on our plates, but who's sitting at the table. Tonight, through the lens of a chef owner, a farmer, an organizer, and policy director, we will address one big problem. How do we create a more equitable and inclusive good food movement? Our conversation this evening will be framed by four big solutions: policy, agency and ownership, movement building, and resiliency. It's important to recognize that this leadership has been provided by women of color across the food system for decades, from the Southern Kitchen of Edna Lewis to the field organizing of Dolores Huerta. Not to mention our country's long history of countless Black and Native women who, enslaved in fields and kitchens, shaped our most celebrated foodways, recipes, and agricultural practices. Now, some things you'll hear tonight may make you feel uncomfortable or make you think, likely both. I ask that you thoughtfully listen and actively respect our panelists. And recognizing the hard work, advocacy, and leadership of women of color in our food system, please help me in welcoming our illustrious panelists. So to start, we have Joanne Lowe, the co-director of the Food Chain Workers Alliance and the chair of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council. Joanne. We have Brittany Chiquata, who is the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. Brittany. We also have Kristen Leach, who is the farmer for Namugaji restaurant here in San Francisco. Kristen. And we also have Dominica Rice Cisneros, who's the chef and owner of Cosecha Cafe in Oakland. Okay, so let's get started. I'm going to sit down. We sit in the matriarchy. So thank you, ladies, for being here this evening. I'm so excited. So my first question for all of you, and feel free to answer whoever feels moved first. In his 2010 essay, Michael Pollan called the food movement a big, lumpy tent, and sometimes the various factions beneath it are working at cross purposes. So we've seen in the good food movement, given its expanse, its struggle to unite under one premise, and works in its silos. And I want to hear from you all, how would you describe our current good food movement? And where do you see yourself and the organizations that you represent within that movement?
Sure. I'll go. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming, and thank you, Shakira, for inviting me. So again, I'm Joanne Lowe. I'm co-director of the Food Chain Workers Alliance. We're a national coalition of unions and worker centers throughout the food system. And 9 of our member groups, we now have 26, but 9 of them came together in 2009 to start the alliance for 2 major reasons. One was to come together as workers all across the food chain to challenge corporations that are dominating our food system. And second, because they could see this growing food movement or movements, but that really wasn't much about workers. And they also recognized that a lot of organizations were working in silos, and so we wanted to be a part of changing that and to bring worker issues to be central to what the good food movement is about. And so that's been a large part of our work. A couple years ago, we co-founded the Heal Food Alliance, because I think more individuals and organizations in the food movement now do recognize the need to work together, that we're not going to be able to transform the food system into one that we want unless we work together. So the Heal Food Alliance, we co-founded with the Movement Strategy Center, Union of Concerned Scientists, and Real Food Challenge. And HEAL stands for Health, Environment, Agriculture, and Labor. So it's really trying to bring together these disparate parts of the food movement to come together and work together.
Thank you. I'll jump in. Hi, everybody. So again, my name is Brittany Chiquata. I work with the American Heart Association. And I really see my role as twofold. So one, it's educating policymakers on the economic and social realities of people who live at the margins in their districts, which is just code for people of color, low-income people, LGBTQ, elderly, and other identities that we might not necessarily want to name or call out, and just it's easier to call them priority populations. And part two of my work is working with community stakeholders, one, to advocate for themselves, and two, to help draw the connection between food systems, environments, and health outcomes, because to get to your question, Shakira, I think when I think of good food movement or slow food movement, or when a lot of folks think about it, that's bougie and inaccessible and not for me. And so it's really taking the conversation from individual behavior blaming, particularly as it relates to body image and nutrition conversations, and really talking about the systemic barriers to living healthy lives.
My name is Kristen, and I'm a farmer for NAMU, the NAMU family who's here. I think when you first posed this question to us, I was sitting there and being like, wait, am I part of a movement? Like, is that? I tend to basically like a 1.5-acre parcel of land, and we do a style of farming that most people think is really kind of crazy and strange. And so when I did just think about it, I thought about like what I felt a lot of pressure, like, oh, what's like, I'm going to be on this panel with all these really smart people. There's going to be all these smart people in the audience. And I think when we've kind of worked in alliance with different more formal organizing groups or movement building groups, we hear things about moving the dial forward and putting the needle up or whatever it is that people are saying. A lot of things about moving things fast and forward. And my farming practice is very slow and very deliberate and very small and focused on that. But at the core of it, I think what, if anything, I feel capable of speaking to in regards to something that I think is important to movement building would be that my forum centers everything about relationships. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of at the core of what we do. Central to anything is just guiding principles about what it means for us to relate to land, our responsibility to it, to being stewards in a responsible way, thinking about the long term. And then, I became a farmer, and I kept doing farm work because it is a really direct way to care for the people around me. I think that in some maybe non-direct way, I feel like must be part of what fuels our movements. And I think if we're thinking about resiliency and things like that, my life and the work that I'm doing, however small it may seem at times, I feel like emboldened by, as much as anything, just in that I'm surrounded by people that I really love and care about. Everybody that sort of orbits my world and my farm are people that I just respect to the core and who inspire me, so.
Thank you for inviting me today. My name is Dominica Rice Cisneros, and I'm from, I live in Oakland for the past 12 years, and my cafe has been open for 5 years. It's our anniversary right now, and we've been celebrating for a week. And we're in the Swans Housewives Market, and this is a market I've been visiting for about, just myself for, off and on for about, 18 years, and I'm kept asking the question, why? Why is this market not teeming with people? Why is it slowed down? What's going on? Oakland's amazing. The people are amazing. We're in the Bay Area. This is a food market, indoor farmers market in the Bay Area. This needs to come back to life. There was just a few butchers, hanging out, doing their thing, and kind of very sleepy. And so I was just like, did my research, did the paperwork, which is grueling, and finally, opened 5 years ago, and I gave it 3 months. I'm like, okay, we'll be open for 3 months, and if we do that, I'm satisfied. If the neighborhood needs us, we'll stay. And sure enough, the neighborhood has come out for us, and it's been there every day, and this moment is just, thank you for inviting me today. And I wanted to be a part of the market and face the market. And the doors roll up every morning at 8:00. And we have no doors of our own. We are in the market. We are part of the street. We are there. And I decided that. And the city asked me not to do that. They said, build a wall. Be your own bougie taco boutique. And I'm like, no, I want to face the market. I want to be in the market. I don't want to hide behind a door. So every morning, that's what we do. And we want to save space for children and grandmas. And we don't just sell tacos. We don't just sell food. We sell peace of mind. You're bringing your family to us. We're going to take care of them.
Thank you, Dominica. I think each one of your answers really segues nicely into my next question. And each one of you have talked about coalition building or making space or uplifting voices. And one quote that really has stuck with me is that of the critical rallying cry of woman of color feminist Flavia Dozadan, where she said, "My feminism will be intersectional or it will be bullshit." And thinking about that cry and that critique, how can we apply this thinking to the good food movement? And what are the opportunities for intersectionality in your work or things that maybe we should be thinking about moving forward, if not you personally? So.
I was very inspired by women in Oakland who were helping us with our bar program, Jessica and Zoe and Crystal, and they were just like, you know, this month we're only shopping and supporting businesses that are owned by people of color, you know? So it's just, you know, in the middle of winter, super cold, super hard to get people out of their homes and into the street and shopping and eating and going to cafes. I mean, that's easy in the summer, that's easy in spring. But in the winter, it's a different game. And so they're just like, no, we're going to do this. And we're going to, you know, put, you know, a direction towards our money, where we're going to spend our money. And it's not just shop locally, but it's just thinking about the big picture. Just not just what is local, but the women who run these businesses, the people of color who run these businesses, you know. And that for me was super inspiring, and I've just kind of taken to that definitely and focus on that.
So thinking about, if we are talking about intersectionality, starting with intention.
Got it.
So from my perspective, confronting the barriers that uphold institutional racism and poverty is always going to be intersectional, right? Because it's not just talking about you know, why soda is intentionally priced cheaper than water in my neighborhood versus someone else's neighborhood. And it's not just about there not being healthy retailers, healthy food retailers in my neighborhood. It's about transportation. It's about zoning laws. It's about the history of redlining, the history of colonialism. And I don't think that you can talk about health opportunities, health outcomes, without including all those things in the conversation. And a lot of people bristle when you bring them into bring these concepts to the forefront, mainly because they make folks uncomfortable, mainly because they make white folks uncomfortable, because that's not your life experience or reality, or you just think that, you know, I'm being hyperbolic to bring it into the conversation. But, you know, what's hyperbole to you, or a nightmare to you in Knob Hill, is 5 a.m. every morning in Bayview Hunters Point. So, you know, I'm not going to be silent just because it makes you uncomfortable when, you know, a 5-year-old is getting up at 5:30 every day to get on the bus with their mom and walking through a neighborhood, you know, where they might get shot before they get to the bus, going to a school that can't afford PE, can't pay for a new gym, so Coca-Cola sponsored it. Mom's working a job that doesn't pay a living wage, and then when she gets home, she's too tired to catch the bus to the real food store, because, like I said, the one in her neighborhood doesn't provide it. So I think we have to talk about all these things, education, labor, when we talk about health opportunities. And I, you know, living in the Bay Area, being from San Francisco, growing up in the Fillmore, now living in Oakland, I think that, you know, talking about gentrification is the perfect entree to talk about health, because, you know, everyone who I know has heard the saying, as soon as Whole Foods is coming to the neighborhood, it's over, right? And how sick is that? I mean, it's funny, I guess, but it's also pretty sick that a resident's worth and right to have access to healthy foods only comes after richer people move into that neighborhood. I think that's crazy that's accepted. And I think, like I said, I think there are a lot of opportunities in the conversations around gentrification to talk about health opportunities, and that we need to, because, you know, a lot of folks don't, it's not top of mind, people don't think about it, and that's, again, when I think the conversation goes back to blaming individual behavior and not talking about how these things are working in tandem and with intention to make sure that my zip code trumps my genetic code.
Anyone have a response to Brittany?
Well said.
Yes.
So kind of following up a little bit on what you were talking about and how for low-income communities of color, especially have, you know, very limited access to good food, right? That's something that we've been focused on as Food Chain Workers Alliance, but also in working with other organizations. So the LA Food Policy Council brought together a very diverse group of individuals and organizations and developed what we call the Good Food Purchasing Policy. So it's a policy for institutions that has standards in what we call five value categories. So buying more food locally, supporting local farms and food businesses, those that have good environmental environmentally sustainable practices, good labor practices, treat animals humanely, and provide healthy, you know, nutritious food. And our focus has been really with cities and school districts because we want to bring more good food to low-income communities, to students, to seniors, right? So that's not just for people who can afford to shop at Whole Foods or something like that. And it's really, we're really trying to address those inequities in the food system. Who's getting paid less? It's usually workers of color, right? Women, LGBTQ. And so the policy also so has standards in all those five value categories and also is encouraging those institutions to buy more food from businesses owned by women and by people of color. And so that's just one example of a policy that we're working on. And actually, San Francisco Unified School District adopted this good food purchasing policy in the spring, and Oakland Unified, it looks like, will adopt in the fall.
Yeah, let's not for that.
Did you want to say something?
Can I want to say one thing?
Go for it.
Okay. I guess mostly I can speak to more the perspective as like a farmer and looking at rural areas and the way that having a, you know, intersectional identity bingo card that's kind of full as an individual, you know, impacts. I mean, I think pretty much when we talk to a lot of other farmers in the Bay Area, we think about poverty and hunger and the way that it impacts us, me as a resident in Alameda County, with a farm in Alameda County, looking at how little land is available within Alameda County to feed people here. You know, I think that having some framework for intersectional analysis makes a lot of sense, just because in just a pure resource level, all of those identities are attached to experiences that severely limit your access to whether it's, yeah, good interactions with the USDA or other agencies that are easier to interact with depending on your experience and where you're coming from, the ability to own land, have a secure sort of land tenure. So I don't have any good solution for that. I'm not like a policymaker, but I do think that if there's one thing that I do feel like can anchor that my part of the conversation is just rural access, safety in rural communities for people who are coming from a range of different experiences.
Thank you. So I want to dig a little bit deeper. So if we're thinking about this intersectional analysis and how we apply that to movement building, so Joanne, you have had a lot of experience over the past decade, particularly in the labor movement, and we've seen a lot of successes within that movement, from the Domestic Workers Alliance to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and their tomato campaign against fast food companies, to most recently with the Fight for 15 here in California. So I was wondering, in our thinking about movement building and learning lessons from folks who have different experiences than us, what are the strategies and tools that we can maybe take or listen to from the labor movement and apply that to what we see in the good food movement?
Sure. Well, let me first say the labor movement is also not a monolith, so it's pretty diverse. But I do think that a number of organizations, worker centers, and unions have been focused more on not just focusing on like workplace issues, but like where do those issues intersect with other forms of oppression. So I think the Fight for 15 has been really strong and working closely with, you know, Black Lives Matter. Because, you know, if you look at who's in the workforce, obviously, in those low-wage jobs, a lot of black people, right? And most of our farm worker organizations in the Food Chain Workers Alliance also, you know, they're focused on, of course, on wages for farm workers, which are very low, health and safety conditions. And so they're working, they work closely with groups like the Pesticide Action Network of North America, trying to decrease the use of pesticides, right? Because that's an issue where it doesn't affect just the environment or, you know, our water, but it also impacts the farm workers and the farmers, the rural communities around them, and also all of us as eaters, right? So I think many groups in the labor movement are looking for ways of how they can work with others and other movements and on other issues. Mm-hmm. I also think that we can learn from the Good Food Movement can really learn from the labor movement about taking direct action and you know, being out in the streets, taking, sitting down in a corporation, right? Because that's how we've seen in history, like direct action has won changes in our society, right? In the workplace. And combining that with having like direct policy demands and making changes in our laws. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something we, you know, the Good Food Movement can learn from the labor movement. Mm-hmm.
And I want, Brittany, I want you to build upon that because in your experience, and thinking about those different tactics and strategies, particularly with health. So one example is how, you know, the speaking of movements learning from another movement, Big Food has learned a lot from Big Tobacco in the past two decades and how to target communities of color. Mm. And, you know, on the ballot in November, we do have a soda tax here in San Francisco and one on the ballot for Oakland as well. So I was wondering, and thinking about Joanne's feedback, what are some of the tools and strategies that we should be thinking about in helping uplift communities of color and low-income communities with, you know, Big Food, you know, learning from the highly successful, you know, Big Tobacco CEOs of the past? So.
Yeah, definitely. I wholeheartedly support soda taxes, and we can argue back and forth on that all night. And I think that we need to be more critical and go back, you know, more than two decades when we talk about the relationship between Big Tobacco or Big Food and communities of color. Because, you know, what I see and hear internally is a lot of blaming or calling organizations of color sellouts because they took $25,000 for a new church roof and didn't endorse the soda tax. And I feel like that's such a shortcut when you're talking about, you know, why NAACP is not on the front lines with you for your soda tax. Because where were you when black people were not getting any loans or having access to any type of wealth? And the only people who were stepping in were tobacco and Big Food. So the relationship between communities of color and you know, these bigger organizations is much more complicated than just these small grants that they get in the heat of these campaigns. And, you know, Big Food is much more strategic than to just, you know, be coming to their church meetings or wherever they're finding folks to get them to not speak out in support of soda taxes. And as far as the tactics that they're using, nothing is surprising. So, you know, black and brown children are seeing twice as many advertisements for sugary drink commercials as white children. And like I said before, there's a lot of targeting of poor schools with sponsorships from Big Food. And what does that mean? Coca-Cola is going to be on the buzzer and on the track field and in all these spaces that are confusing, you know, athleticism and Gatorade consumption with being synonymous somehow. and as far as strategies go, like I said, there's a lot of misconceptions internally and excitement to call folks out for not getting in line, so to speak. And that translates into bad campaigns. So when folks of color or the stakeholders are not at the table and are only tokenized at the 25th hour to be your messenger, it doesn't work. We need to be at the table making decisions about how the policy is written, how that money is coming back into the community, and what our outreach strategy is going to be. I can't just come help you when you have made all the decisions. And so that disconnect is simultaneously hilarious and frightening, because I had no idea personally, you know, what an inclusive space public health is until I started working in it. And so I'm making it my business to disrupt that space and call folks out with love, or call folks in. I don't know what you're supposed to say today. But just have more honest conversations, because, like I said, that translates into bad campaigns. We can't keep losing because people are dying from preventable diseases.
Snaps. I wanna keep talking about conversations. I think based on all of your answers here, we have decided or have come to terms with food justice is social justice. It's about high time in the United States, and I think that conversation is being brought forth by Black Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter. And last year we had direct action by BLM activists in Oakland through Black Brunch, and where they kind of brought their demands and naming the names of folks who have been cut down by state-sanctioned violence in restaurants in Oakland, and challenging people at the table. So, and I actually want to hear from you, Dominica. What was your kind of perception of that as a restaurant owner? Another question I have is, how do we start having those hard, difficult conversations at the table? And who should lead them?
Wow. Definitely the workers, definitely. You know, I started in the food industry when I was 14 years old. And so as a child, and then growing up in the food industry, and, you know, I was definitely raised by a family that was involved in the food industry since day one. So it was just my grandmother crossing the border 100 years ago, and, you know, moving from one hacienda to another. So from northern Mexico, then to Texas, and then to New Mexico. And you can see her migration and her cooking style. So I can see now, like, okay, she spent some time in Albuquerque. You know what I mean? I can see it. And she didn't have to tell me. I can just see it now. But, you know, she passed away during the same time as the Los Angeles riots. So, you know, for myself, like, leaving my work after we were allowed to leave because of the kind of martial law that had taken over Los Angeles in that time, in 91. And then finding out my grandmother was in the hospital in downtown. So driving to downtown, seeing the fire from her window of her hospital, that she was diagnosed with cancer and passed away that same year. But seeing, you know, the streets on fire, and seeing my grandmother, who taught us everything, and, you know, being the next generation and deciding for myself, it's very, very, you know, emotional. But it's the workers who are the ones who are going to have to be at this conversation, the forefront. And so for at Cosecha in Oakland, since we started, you know, we've always set a goal to, you know, it's money. People have to get paid. They have to get paid. They have to take care of their kids. You know, there's scholarships to get paid. There's books that have to get purchased. There's, you know, bus fares to get paid every day to get to work and back. Mm-hmm. So we've made it a policy from day one to always strive above and beyond minimum wage every time. Like, way before the 15 is in place for California, we're just like, okay, let's go for it. Let's already get people there on our staff. You know, from day one, we're like, okay, let's, everybody gets shared tips. You know, it's never just a front of the house thing, back of the house thing. And, you know, because it's always for us, it's always just, it's a worker thing. We're feeding workers at Cosecha. So there's people from everywhere in Oakland that, you know, we have lawyers, we have judges, we have, you know, Alice Waters, we have warriors in lines, and then we also have people who are, you know, severely addicted to drugs and living on the streets, you know, trying to get a meal, a hot meal. So everybody waits in line, everybody gets served, and it's all good, but it's definitely a worker, it has to be a worker, workers first.
Where else will we have these conversations? And then I would also push from restaurants, what are the spaces that we need to occupy in order to these conversations to happen, particularly in the good food movement?
I mean, I think some of the conversations are already really alive and active, and I just don't want to minimize the potency of informal networks and how people really build community outside of the system and the system's sort of flaws. And I guess, yeah, I've just been really stoked on, like, transformative justice kind of framework and questioning really what would it take for us to really divest from a system we all know is failing most of us and create something alternative in its place. And I think that there is a lot of power, and just, like, out of sheer necessity, the fact that people are, like, already doing this. They're already kind of, you know, Miles Horton at Highlanders, that you make the road by walking, and that's kind of just, like, what I feel like is in action. And I suppose just an example would be, we work with the Korean American Coalition to End Domestic Abuse. So some part of your framing was talking about just, when you're really under the gun, you're feeling, like, the extreme acute pressure of, like, how violent this system can be to live under. How do you prioritize, like, making these decisions that, yeah, get kind of seen as lifestyle and bourgeois? And certainly, like, a lot of the members that that organization works with are experiencing a lot of really traumatic situations. And we've sort of come together to see, not just, like, we provide a lot of donated vegetables through, like, a small CSA through them. And so there's, like, the reality that, like, hunger, health disparities due to food access are an outcome of kind of, yeah, just capitalism. But if we can sort of, like, rewrite, not that we're just trying to change those outcomes and say, like, people need more access to food, but that food is really entrenched in how we reach that end goal. And it becomes really sort of embroidered in the process and not just seen as, like, what we're trying to kind of, like, alleviate. Because the system is not, like, a failure that people are hungry. It's, like, very deliberate. It's very insidious, like, who is kept hungry and for what purposes. So with Casita, we tried to just really make it enlivening and make it something so that, yeah, we're providing them food, but at the end of the day, that's not the most impactful outcome that we're seeing with working with that group and what it means to live with interpersonal violence, live with systemic violence, most times simultaneously. And there's something that just with understanding that food, cultural food ways, and having some point of relevance that tethers you to those, and working from that point of, like, what really resonates with people. What are you trying to say? Yeah, I think that that restores some sense of imagination, which I think is a really necessary ingredient when we're talking about any sort of movement building, because it can feel so shitty. It just feels like so, you just feel like embattered by how bad things can feel. Mm-hmm. So I think to have some sense of expansiveness when you're experiencing, like, maybe one of the harder times of your life, but to remember, remember your lineage, remember the things that in some way provided some physical nourishment and kind of, like, what, makes you think about what you want to kind of pass on and carry on, I think is a really important,
reminder.
Really important part.
Yeah. Yes, Tamika.
For myself, mentorship was a huge component to finally being able to create my own team and to continue to work every day. I have my mentors, and they're hard to come by. And the city of Oakland was definitely there for me from day one, and they still are. And, you know, you can find mentors in very interesting locations, but it's just really, we need organizations to reach out to businesses, small businesses that are have been in the community, current communities, like in West Oakland, who need to go to the next stage. Mm-hmm. They need mentors to get to the next level. So, you know, there's a fear sometimes with small businesses that if you start hiring too many staff, at some point it's not going to work out, and then you're going to have to fire people, and it's not going to pay off. I mean, so there's a fear there, and you don't want to set that situation up. But with the right mentorship, with outreach, with, you know, the next generation coming in and finding the support, asking, letting them know, like, you know, how do you use Instagram? Like, how do you start posting? How do you reach to the new clientele, which are now like 21? So, you know, working with established companies that are already there, you want to see them, you know, get to the next level. And I think organizations need to tap into those businesses that they want to keep in their communities.
Can I add on, or you want to move on?
Make it snappy.
Okay. So my two cents in that conversation is just the future is femme, past is femme, the present is femme, but like for sure the future is.
Yeah.
And I think that people understand that women need more power. We need to have more decision-making power, like more structural power. We've always had power. We've always been the ones in the home who are making decisions that affect the world. We know that Michelle is the real MVP, and that women are going to lead the movement.
I would concur. And to build upon that, I want to talk about, I know we've talked about larger issues and the organizations that you work within, but how do you stay personally resilient in this movement? Kristen talked about things feeling so bad. So how do you show up for yourself, and how do you show up for maybe other women of color in your care?
Start cooking for yourself. Start making meals for your family, yeah, at home. Start there. It's really important. I mean, for a few years I wasn't doing that, and it's I had to slow down and concentrate on my child, my husband, myself, and then the community and the neighborhood.
I definitely identify with that. I think working for Bi-Rate and having so many amazing ingredients at all times, although Bi-Rate pays me and I give it right back to them. But I definitely think grounding myself in the kitchen or over a pot of jam or, you know, just with others or feeding others has definitely been a part of my own personal resilience. Also, going to Kabuki Spa it's been a really key part. Anyone else want to share any other stories of personal resilience?
For me, it's just been really important to be intentional about the community that I build. Because I think that, you know, as I've gone through school and different jobs, I feel myself ascending into this ivory tower that I've always rejected. And I basically have to check myself, like, you know, check your privilege, number one, but make sure you're around good people who aren't making you tuck in parts of your personality, because those happen in very subtle, very real ways. And so for me, it's just been like making sure that my community is good and that they're checking me like, well, why are you wearing your hair in a bun all week? Like, let it go. Let those curls out. Like, little things where you're just like, how can I quiet myself in this space? Not being quiet and being big.
I think as leaders in our organizations or in our communities, we also have a responsibility to create the kind of like a culture that we want, and a culture of care and love for each other. And I really, you know, I really loved hearing Dominica talk about in her restaurant, you know, caring for the staff all together, right? And so I've tried to be very intentional with in our organization to care for each other and to also give people freedom to like and to trust each other. Like, if you don't need to work 9 to 5, if you want to go to yoga class at 11 a.m., just go, and I'm going to trust that you're going to do what you need to do for yourself and for the organization.
And speaking about that care and that intentionality and, you know, making sure we're creating the type of community that's going to help us thrive, all of us thrive, I want to talk about who are our other women of color leaders who are not on the stage. And it's not as if these leaders need voices, but maybe they need ears. And how do we cultivate leaderships across our movement for more women of color? So love to kind of hear from you all. Who are those women? Where are they? How can we create space and community with them?
I'll go first. For us, it's really important to develop the leadership and space for workers, especially women workers and workers of color, immigrant workers, to share their stories, to learn from each other, to feel connected, because oftentimes workers feel very isolated, mm-hmm. that, you know, what they're facing is just where they are. And so we organize an annual worker leaders retreat. Our member groups bring workers from all over the country, all different races, ethnicities, backgrounds. And it's been really powerful to see workers from, you know, in a black woman worker from Chicago, who only speaks English, who's, you know, connected with a Latina immigrant worker in a pork processing plant in Missouri, and we had a translator, and they shared experiences, and they were like, oh my God, that's what I'm experiencing, even though they're in different sectors, and they cried together, and, you know, but they could feel that they're part of now a broader movement, and so we really try and lift up their leadership and their stories, and, you know, we've worked closely with the Real Food Media, and we have a project called Voices of the Food Chain. Mm-hmm. So we have videos, and like StoryCorps came and recorded conversations with workers. So that's really core to what we do, is to lift up those voices and to show, like, even though these workers are often invisible to most people, to most eaters, we rely on them, and their stories are important.
Thank you.
I think it's the caretakers who are at home right now getting dinner ready, mm-hmm. Who are missing. And so it's, you know, the mamas, the nanas, the folks who are caring for our loved ones who aren't making any money doing that work. And I think that, you know, everything from caretaking in the home to cultivating food has lost dignity in the U.S., right? We don't think of those jobs as dignified jobs, even though they're, like, the most critical jobs. And I think that that's a huge barrier, is just talking about the like, value, giving value back to the folks who, you know, the silent heroes who helped since the foundation of the U.S. And who were just, you know, X'd out of history.
Kristen, did you have some?
Farmers and grandmas, not mutually exclusive.
definitely moms and moms, definitely. I mean, we have an all-female kitchen. They're all moms and grandmas. We all work every morning together, 5 years straight. And in the evening, we let some guys help us, you know. But definitely, you know, we have our customers who, you know, a lot of moms and grandmas come in, and they see that the tortillas are made by hand. So when they order it, they're going to be made as you go, as the orders come in. And they're not sitting, getting stale, and all that horrible stuff. So they know what they're buying into is that they're helping that lady right there who has a skill level that's super high to make hundreds of tortillas, giving her a job. So they keep coming back and keep coming back. And they know, they can see our kitchen's out in the open. They can see everybody chopping everything by hand. We're not buying bags of pre-cut onions from Sysco or whatever. And we're just, we're chopping everything by hand so they can see it. So they're for me, they're my leaders. They're showing us and the community that there is room for this. There is room to slow down, see things hand-chopped, and see things and taking that home or eating that with their kids. And these mothers are from every ethnicity, and they're coming in every day, and they're sharing their money and their power with us. And they're saying, you're staying in our neighborhood. So I'm very grateful.
Thank you. So in addition to the workers and the grannies and the mothers and the cooks, I would also add our youth. I work with a lot of young people through our work at Byright and through local high schools. And I want to make sure that the system or all the things that I'm feeling and working with today, they don't have to. We don't have to say Black Lives Matter because it's understood. We don't have to say Good Food Matters because it's there for everyone. It's understood. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the future, I was wondering, and this is going to be our last question before we head into questions for our audience. If you haven't already, there's been comment cards I've gone around, so please ask us a good one. But to our panelists, you know, what is one illustrative example of what a good, inclusive food movement can look like? It can be something as small where you're not the only person integrating a farmer's market, or as big as, you know, you're at the head of the table for that big food company. But I'd love to hear from all of you, what does a good inclusive food movement look like 5, 10, 15, 50 years from now?
I think a year from now, especially in West Oakland, all over Oakland, you know, there's a lot of interesting, you know, new landowners and nervous landowners who are designing and redesigning Oakland. And, you know, they're curating Oakland right now. And so I'm pushing back, and I'm like, well, you need 5 more, you know, cooperative food markets in West Oakland. You need maybe 10 more. You know, and this should be all over in the first floor, ground level of all the new condos that are going up. And they should get, you know, a year free rent after construction. You know, they need, and a lot of people, I think they feel like maybe they don't deserve that. I'm like, yes, they do. This is what the community needs. And if you want your buildings to go up on time and on schedule, then you need to make sure that the neighborhoods around it that's established is their needs are being met.
In my mind's eye, I think it's going to be confronting a lot of the like historic policy interventions that have gotten us to this point. So instead of, you know, continuing to kind of chip away, I think it's going to take a larger confrontation because, similar to a lot of the economic policy decisions that have been made that perpetuate poverty, there have been a ton of food policy and health policy decisions that perpetuate disease. So we're going to have to confront, you know, these subsidies that make it so easy to produce unhealthy, nutrition-free processed food and move away from this idea that there is no time to eat well.
Well, I guess similar to what Joanne said about labor, like I think agriculture is also not a monolith, but I think that there's not a deep enough conversation about how we grow things and the food production aspect of our food system. There's just like this consent we have that it's okay if it relies on endless resource extraction, if it relies on just constant assumption that we'll have access to water and oil to the extent that we do. And so I think, to me, I'm just excited to, to see more deepening of conversation about the fact that we need to come up with really, just more realistic kind of expectations for how we're going to weather climate change in various scenarios to produce food for people to access, hopefully, to a greater degree.
Hopefully. So I'll try and be quick. For me and for the Food Chain Workers Alliance, really think that the good food movement needs to be led by the people most negatively impacted by our corporate food system. So that means people of color and women and immigrants in the leadership of the movement, and that there are more opportunities for workers, for community members to own our means of production. I'm just going to go there. And so there's an example that's been developing in Cincinnati, a worker-owned farm called Our Harvest, and that now they're expanding to a retail store in a low-income neighborhood in Cincinnati, and they're going to be hiring from within that neighborhood, mostly people of color, low-income residents, and those workers will eventually become owners of that market, and they're going to sell the food that the cooperative farm produces. And so they're trying to create a whole regional food system that is cooperatively owned, that is just and fair and sustainable and healthy.
That is a hopeful future. I think you've all established how we cannot have a sustainable food system that is based on unjust and replicating systems of oppression, for sure. We have an amazing audience, I can tell from all these great questions. We may not get to all of them, but I'll try as best as I can. So the first question I have from a great person. How do you prioritize different elements within the good food movement? For example, if organic and non-GMO is on one level, is it better to just have fresh conventional vegetables instead of maybe something like soda and chips? So I think just touching upon some of the tensions that we talked about earlier in our conversation. So priorities within the good food movement.
You have to start with what's, I think sometimes in my community, in my neighborhood, and where I was raised, is like what is available, so fresh and conventional is sometimes the only option. And so that's just a great starting point. And making a decision not to go to McDonald's or a fast food chain restaurant because it's just easy and the kids are happy or whatever. It's just, you know, starting to cook for yourself with what's available and quick and healthy, and, you know, that worry about the organic and local next. That's the next. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you have to go a little bit more upstream. It's not for me. The priority is, like, what are the health opportunities? Hmm. Not, you know, you need to buy this over this. It's do you even have an opportunity to get that? And so I think that rhetoric is really important when we're talking about, like, public health professionals. Because there's a tendency to, again, condemn individual behavior and not talk about things in a holistic, systemic framework. So I think that, you know, talking about water access over don't drink soda is where the emphasis should be placed. Because, like I said before, if a soda is cheaper than water, then I'm making a fiscally responsible decision to buy that soda.
Do you want to weigh in? No? Okay. Switching gears a little bit, what advice would you give to young women unsure of what direction they should take in the good food industry? And can you relate?
Wow.
You cannot relate.
Yes. Okay.
You knew everything you wanted to do since you were 10 years old.
I guess I would just say whatever speaks to your heart and, like, calls to your passion. Like, in college, I was I majored in environmental biology, and I thought, oh, well, I'll be like a researcher, and that's how I'll help the environment. I got interested in the environment, on environmental issues, in part because of the way the food is produced and hurts the environment and hurts animals. But then while in college, the university employees, their unions were a contract fight, and a big fight was around the dining hall workers and whether they could be subcontracted out or not. And I got involved with a student group to support the workers, and we were organizing student support, and I participated in marches, and I was like, oh my God, this is like where my passion is. This is where I feel I can make a difference. And I finished my major, but you know, so it's just whatever calls to you and you follow your passion, I think. Maybe it might take you a while to find it, but that's okay.
Don't be afraid. If you're, you know, really young and no money, it's like, go for it. You know, just put yourself in a very uncomfortable situation at times, you know, and it's okay, especially if you're from California, because if you're moving really far away, you're buying a one-way ticket and you're working somewhere, you arrive with nothing with you, a resume and like $200, and you're waiting for a stage or, you know, an apprenticeship or something, or, you know, line cook job anywhere. It doesn't matter. I mean, nobody's going to feel sorry for you. You know, just go for it. You know, travel as much as possible and put yourself out there. See what is going on. Find your mentors, and just don't take no for an answer.
So stepping into that power.
Yeah.
I definitely, to answer that question, I definitely think going to events like this is very helpful. I know a lot of folks in this room, we have media organizations, we have chefs, we have nonprofit organizations, we have farmers markets, lots of food businesses, labor organizations. All of that cultural capital and social capital is here in this room. So being brave and connecting with folks and networking is definitely a great start for young people. I've gotten 4 questions about white allyship. So, and a lot of questions on where to start. So how can our white allies join or even start in the conversation?
The money. The money. That's it. You know, support the, you know, worker-owned and, you know, the co-ops and the women-owned businesses and people of color-owned farms. We make a point of finding farms that are women-owned and or urban farmers or are people of color-owned farms and organic, and, you know, we support them as much as possible, definitely.
For sure.
My request of white allies is always the same, no matter like what the context is of that question. And the answer is, start at home. Talk to your people. Mm-hmm. We know what's going on over here. And instead of coming to like our meetings and taking space, talk to your people around your kitchen table, because that is how change happens, in these personal, uncomfortable interactions. You don't need to come to the meeting and say how down you are. We know you showed up. Thank you. Go tell your mom that.
And just to add to that, is also look within your own organizations or businesses. Like, who are you surrounded by? Like, do you represent the broader community or the neighborhood you're in? Who's on your staff? Who's on your board? Who's in the leadership? And really take a critical look at that.
There's a lot of amazing also organizations in the Bay Area. One of them is called Showing Up for Racial Justice, SURGE. And that's a great place to start for white allies and trying to come to terms with the sorts of strategies, direct action, and understanding your privilege in a space with other white allies. So another resource. One juicy question that I got, because I feel like we've been so kumbaya on this panel, is how are places like Bairei and Namu helping in this movement being so expensive themselves?
Wow.
Do you want to start, or should I start?
I don't know.
yeah, no, totally. I get this question every day. Thank you for asking. I think when places at Bayreuth, we prioritize a few things, right? A good food movement, given the current state of subsidies, of lack of support for our farmers, lack of the expense of operating a small food business in a very expensive place to live, means that we have to prioritize certain things, and that comes off in the true cost of our food. So when you shop at Bayreuth, yes, you're going to pay $5 for that tomato, but then I have health insurance, I have a retirement plan, and I can promote and help my staff, right? When you buy that $10 granola at Bayreuth, that was made by a woman of color who came up through La Cocina, a local organization dedicated to immigrant and low-income workers who didn't have access to commercial kitchen space, and now they can and operate and survive in San Francisco. When you shop at Bayreuth, we can get a better wage or price for our farmers, so we don't have to nickel and dime them like other grocery stores, and they can do things like put the money back into their land or work above poverty wages. So yes, I'm part of our marketing team. I get this question every day. I also get to put $250,000 back into San Francisco through our philanthropy and through our youth development programs and hiring programs. So a dollar spent with us, 100% of that dollar goes back into San Francisco and the Bay Area. A dollar spent elsewhere, you're going to see probably around 30 cents to 40 cents on that dollar being seen back in San Francisco. So also with my community development experience, it's not for me to tell folks who can't shop at Bayreuth that they should buy organic food. I want to empower them in their own communities, so which is why we work with corner store owners in the Tenderloin and the Bayview in Oakland, and how they can have healthy retail strategies by sharing our institutional knowledge. So that's some of the things that we do on our side to help bridge that gap. It's not perfect. It is expensive. But there's definitely reasons behind that. So I'm sorry. We have our food donated tonight. You can eat that. But and the same goes for Namu. Did you want to say anything else?
No, I mean, I think, yeah, all of those things about the true cost and all of that, it's hard for me to answer that because I see such a particular facet of, like, just the people that are behind that, and I think it's just impossible for me to just see it as just this, capitalist venture. They're, like, these really intensely anti-capitalist people involved in this very capitalist venture in a very capitalist society. I think as a farmer, I can just say that I would have never had the opportunity that I had were it not for their investment in me. And I've just been a farm worker for my adult life. I don't have a savings account. I wouldn't have had a way to launch my own farming venture were it not for them believing in me and really putting their money where their mouth is in terms of sustainability. Yeah, and the things that we need to problem solve right now to ensure that our food system is more equitable in the future. Like, I think that, yeah, whatever problematic parts there are about the restaurant industry, its role in the Bay Area, all of these different things, I believe that Namu is, like, investing in the future in a really substantive way that I don't know many other people, organizers or entrepreneurs alike, are actually walking the walk. And for me, we're trying to do a lot of things to innovate within our industry of farming and small-scale farming and finding creative solutions on a very small plot of land to make, like, not only a livelihood, but to, enliven ecosystems, to merge conservation and agriculture. And all of those things are necessary things to figure out. And as we talked about, research for these types of things is very narrow. I don't feel that empowered as an individual to access a lot of that funding. I don't have a background in science or a degree in anything farming related. And so this was the way that made sense, was through this collaborative venture where everyone's doing what they care about. So thank I don't you. Feel that bad about it.
Well, I just want to add, it's also important to have companies like BuyRight or NAMU that are doing the right thing, are doing good things, right? But also to think beyond, like, if you can, of course, we should support these businesses, spend our dollars there, but to think beyond ourselves as consumers, because we also need to challenge those corporations that are providing the cheap food, right, that externalize their costs of that cheap food onto all of us, right, and to support policies that make it harder for them to make that cheap food, right? Like raising the minimum wage, because that levels the playing field for restaurants like NAMU and Cosecha that believe in paying a living wage. That's important to using our power as active citizens, whether you are legally a citizen or not, doesn't matter. But like, you know, using your voice to win systemic change, that's important too.
I have two more questions. So one, what system is in place? So we talked a lot about cooking and cooking for ourselves and our families, for resilience and for nourishment, but also for care. So what system is in place for low-income families that don't have the time, knowledge, experience in cooking healthy meals for their families? And what spaces are doing this without shame and shaming folks?
So there are a ton of community organizations that do teach people about alternatives to sugary drinks, teach families about shopping at farmers markets and how to prepare food purchased in farmers markets, but they're so few and far between, they're not having the grand impact that one would hope for. But I think that in the Bay Area, particularly in Oakland, there's an overabundance of nonprofits that many of which are doing the same work, but I think that there are a lot of informal, whether that be like church spaces or YMCA, where people are getting together and sharing recipes, sharing healthier recipes. Because everyone wants to be healthy at the end of the day. There's this misconception that some people, quote unquote, don't want to be healthy, and there are different definitions of what healthy is or looks like. But everybody wants to be disease free and live a good life with their family.
I would concur. I'd also say definitely here in San Francisco, actually across the Bay Area, there's an organization, there's called 18 Reasons and their Cookie Matters program, which definitely works with not only families and youth to learn, have the confidence to cook every day. They go through an 8-week nutrition program and then go forth and train other folks in their community and do classes on their own, which I think is really fantastic. So if you're looking for a resource or one of the organizations that Brittany brought up. And we are coming to the end of our program. And before it ends, I just wanted to very quickly ask each one of our panelists, first of all, thank you for being here. But before we go, what is your one sentence to change the world? Should I go first?
Probably.
Should I go first?
Yeah, probably.
Dismantle corporate control of our food system. Go.
We need to organize.
If you are neutral in situations of injustice, then you have chosen the side of the oppressor.
That's a good one.
It's not mine, it's Desmond Tutu. It was full disclosure.
Stop, collaborate, and listen. I'm sorry. Is it radical to co-opt someone who calls himself Vanilla Ice at a Women of Color panel? Maybe. No?
Maybe. Just keep supporting women-owned businesses. That's it. Just keep supporting people of color businesses, own businesses. I mean, help them own their own businesses. That's it.
Thank you. So, can we give thanks to our panelists, please? And to close, thank you to our panelists, Brittany, Joanne, Dominica, and Kristen, for their discussion here today about women leaders at the table, addressing inequity in the good food movement. I'm Shakira Simley. We thank all of our audiences here in person and those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, putting you face-to-face with today's thought leaders, is adjourned. Thank you.